And I was up in the loft working on something, John, and I had my Sunday best coveralls on, you know, the ones that have tar stains on it and paint and, you know, all caulking smeared on the side and all kind of stuff. And I'm out in the country and I hear a guy walking across my subfloor. And I look down from the loft and I said, hey, can I help you? And he said, yeah, I'm with the Hutchinson News and we heard about this place and just wanted to know if we could interview you. I said, okay.
Wow.
So
okay.
He takes a couple pictures, asks me what in the world I'm doing. I try to explain it. You got to remember at the time, I didn't know what I didn't know. It was a good article. He got some good pictures of the frame.
The Blue Collar Voices Show.
The answer to the trivia question in the last episode is 1.5 by 3.5 inches wide.
Doc, my only hope.
Marty, I'm sorry, but the only power source capable of generating 1.21 gigawatts of electricity is a bolt of lightning.
What did you say?
A bolt of lightning. Unfortunately, you never know when or where it's ever going to strike.
We do now.
This is it. This is the answer. It says here that a bolt of lightning is going to strike the clock tower precisely 10:04 p.m. next Saturday night. If we could somehow harness this lightning, channel it into the flux capacitor, just might work. Next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future.
Hello, everybody. Today we have on the Blue Collar Voices show, John Van Bruggen. He owns Clydesdale Frames. He does timber framing. We're going to delve into his life and work experiences. He's got about 23 years of experience doing this. And John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Well, I am freaking delighted that you're here. So, John, go ahead and give everybody just a brief summary of what it is you do on a day-to-day basis.
Clydesdale Frames Company is a frame-only timber frame company. We're not posted beam. We are timber frame. The main difference is all of our connections are going to be a wood connection, a mortise and tenon connection, and we build frames. And so frames can be anything from a 16-foot square gazebo all the way up to, you know, big honky-tonks or church sanctuaries or wedding venues or whatever, and all points in between. So we build frames. What the frame is for is really up to the consumer. We build the frame.
All right. You had mentioned in one of our prior conversations getting this set up that you don't use nails.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, John and I have laughed about the technology and my ineptness of it. And my catchphrase is that, hey, I build houses without nails. So that kind of tells you where I'm at on all of that kind of thing. But we really don't. We don't use nails. We use a minimal amount of screws and steel. And it's really, when I started 23 years ago, we might do 10 projects a year, John, and one of them would need engineering for the standpoint of whatever the governing body of the location of the frame was, whether they mandated an engineering stamp. Now we may do 10 projects a year, and only one of them doesn't need engineering. That's kind of one of the ways the industry has changed. So once the engineers get involved, that means they're carrying the liability and they're going to overbuild. There's going to be steel in different places hidden. And so there's a constant push and pull that we have with the engineering guys trying to keep it as traditional as we possibly can. But at the same day, you got to meet the legal requirements.
How deep do you get into the engineering? If you're working with engineers, I assume you've got a fair amount of knowledge.
Well, yeah. I mean, so when I built my house, I was my own engineer, and I brought my plans to the local engineer here in that's close to our shop here in the same town, Hutchinson, Kansas, and kind of went through it with him. He looked at me and he said, "I've never seen anything like this in my whole life." He said, "I've been an engineer for 40 years and I've never looked at a timber frame before." He goes, "Yeah, I think you're okay." And I thought, all right, I'm a little underwhelmed, you know, by that assessment. I wanted a little guidance and really didn't get any initially. So it forced me to kind of work out beam calculations and whatnot with longhand. And I read some of the old timber framing books that like the OGs of the timber framing industry had written way back in the 60s and 70s. And I thought I was good. If you were to look at my house now, you know, there's places where I would say, hey, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know. Now, saying all that, my house still stands. It's, you know, thunderstorms come and go, the winds come and go, and we're still good. But the frames that we build now, the sizes of our timbers are quite a bit bigger than they were when we started. And that's because engineers have gotten involved, and the engineers that we use now, we actually built his house. And so he's well versed.
Does the engineering, well, I guess really what I'm getting to is it can be very tornadic. A lot of tornadoes up in Kansas.
Yes.
How well does the timber frame stand up? And is the larger size also a representation of the additional amount of strength you need because of tornadoes?
Okay, great question. So there's two things that you have to factor in here. The first is that when you look at a timber frame, you have a series of posts. So these are the vertical columns. They're the vertical members of the frame. And then you have a series of horizontal members that we call beams. And they're connected to each other. And then typically there are angle braces or knee braces, different words used, that connect the post to the beam, like on a 45 degree angle. People typically think that that brace is helping to hold up the load that's applied to the beam, like a gravity load, like a downward load. But that isn't true. That isn't what those braces are for. Those braces are to resist a lateral push against the side of the building and to help resist seismic loading. So when the ground rolls like in an earthquake, those braces are going to load. Half of them will be in tension, half of them will be in compression. And as that wave of the ground moves through, they find center again. So in Japan and in a lot of the areas around the world where seismic design is mandatory, you see a lot of buildings that are not only timber frame, they could be a different style building, but they're utilizing the same design feature. And that's inherent to timber framing. So how that works in the Midwest, where you have the tornadoes and the big winds and the big straight line winds and stuff like that, is that that house may shift in that wind, but as that wind passes or as that cell moves past, it rocks back again. Now, when I say it moves or it rocks back, I mean a little, like minuscule. Years ago, we built a house down in Canadian, Texas there. It was a timber frame center section, stick frames on the wings. It got hit by an F3. And I found out about it on the news like a couple weeks after it happened. And I called the builder and I said, "Hey, I haven't got a phone call from you. Are we okay?" And he said, "Well, John, the stick frame wings are out in the pasture. And the timber frame's a quarter inch out of plumb."
Wow.
"And we racked it back with some straps and we're just building right to it." And I said, "Oh, I want some pictures. Send me some pictures." And he said, "Nope." He said, "I know you want pictures, but my homeowner said there's no way. He doesn't want any publicity." And I said, "Copy that."
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to say, John, that they're tornado proof, because I'm never going to tempt the forces of nature that way. Mm-hmm. But they do pretty well. They do pretty well.
So I kind of see two different things here. With the tornado, you have like a stress that's just pushing on it all along the whole way laterally.
Uh-huh.
And in the terms of an earthquake, it could be undulating. It almost seems like that if it's an earthquake situation, I could see it almost like loosely coupled so that it wouldn't be too tightly built from one end to the other. So it could almost flex, if you know what I mean.
That's exactly right. So when you have a tenon that's cut onto the end of a beam, so the tenon would be the male part of the joint. And then you have the mortise that's cut into the post, which would be the female end of the joint. When you put those together and pin it with some oak pegs or some oak pins, those pins don't bear load. Those pins are just really designed to keep that joint on its load-bearing shoulder. Now, when you have that undulating motion of an earthquake or you have the push and the pull of tornadic activity, that joint is going to flex. But as long as the pins hold true and they keep the joint where it's supposed to be, then that frame is going to stand.
Okay. So you look at what you know now, and if you've been doing this for 23 years and you go back to when you started, what would be maybe the most significant thing that you've learned between then and now?
Oh, boy. You almost have to put that question into categories. So when I think about my house, I think about design. If I had to replace my house and build on the same length and width and height dimensions, the same shape, the frame design wouldn't be the same thing. And so I built what was called a common rafter system. So I had a series of beams that would have been like at the plate level or like where the ends of the rafters would join. And then I had some beams that were kind of a mid-span beam that the rafter would attach to as it made its way up toward the ridge. If I were to do that all over again, I would have went with what we call a principal rafter purlin system, where I have four main rafters across 48 feet, across the length of 48 feet, and then I would have connected them with purlins rather than just a series of rafters. To my eye, it just looks cleaner. You know, a stick framer, when he has to do valley rafters or hip rafters, any of that compound joinery, he just has to make it structural. So you put enough 16 penny nails in it with the nail gun and it's structural, then you cover it all up and you can't see any of it. When we build something like that, it has to look like it grew together. And so common rafters are harder to get the joinery to look perfect, while purlins, it's a lot easier to get that joinery to look perfect. That was probably a big hump. Since we're a pre-fit company, John, meaning we try to pre-fit the whole frame inside the shop before it ever leaves, pre-fitting common rafters forces you to build that roof section in the shop. If I'm doing purlins, all that means is I have to lay the rafters down on a series of blocks. So they're laying down horizontal and flat. Make sure they're on dimension. Make sure they're square with one another. And then pull a tape measure from pocket to pocket and cut my purlin to fit, make sure it fits in the pocket, and then I label it. And that purlin's going to fit live. And so does that make sense or is that confusing?
It makes as much sense as it's going to make right now while we're talking about it without the aid of visuals.
Right.
So that's great. How big is your shop that you're staging everything in?
Our shop is about 80 feet wide and about 160 feet long. The main area of it, there's some storage areas off to the side, has two bridge cranes that run back and forth in there.
Oh, wow.
Well, otherwise we're in a chiropractor constantly because the stuff's just too big, too heavy. And then obviously forklifts to move things around.
That is serious heavy duty.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big half round shop. It's a place that we lease. And so there isn't like a straight wall and then the roof. I mean, it's literally a half a circle. It's like a big radius over the top. And so the bridge cranes run down the middle of it. It works well. It doesn't keep all the rain out when it rains, but it's got big power and it's got big space. And we've been there for a long time.
Oh, that's very cool. So how did you get started doing this back in the day when you were a kid? I mean, did you dream about building? What kind of kid were you?
I grew up in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. And usually when I tell people that, they go, oh yeah, that's where, what was that guy's name? The one who guaranteed the Super Bowl, Joe Namath. And I'm like, yeah, Joe Namath and I went to the same high school. And what was funny is that my friend's dads and Joe Namath were all the same age and went to school together. And so in the summertime, when we have block parties and things like that, it wasn't uncommon for Joe to be back in the neighborhood and interacting with his classmates and then all the crazy pack of boys, which I was a part of, running around. And so I didn't think of Joe as being larger than life. Like most people, he was just a guy from the neighborhood. I don't remember having a fascination with building growing up. I was fascinated with football, which is, if you're from Beaver Falls, that's what you're fascinated with. That carried me through high school into college. It was after college. All I ever worked was really carpentry jobs through college. I did concrete work and all kind of stuff. It's when I finally got a full-time job as a fireman. And so I was working 9 days a month on shift. And then that gave me 21 days a month to do whatever I wanted to do. And some guys went golfing, you know, some guys went hunting, fishing, whatever it was. Well, I opened up my own little place and started pouring sidewalks and driveways and room additions and that kind of stuff because I wanted to buy land. And so saved my pennies, bought land, 20 acres, got married in there somewhere, and wanted to build a timber frame house. And I don't really remember the aha moment. I think I just wanted to be different. And so I started exploring this idea of building a timber frame house. And so I was on the job about 9 years as a fireman. One of my captains had been on quite a bit longer than I, but he was also a builder on the side. His name was Mike. And so I talked Mike into exploring this with me, and he was open to it. And so I was getting the timber frame magazines, like Timber Homes Illustrated, I think it was called, something like that. And there was an ad in the back of it for Cowie Mountain Timber Framers. I don't think they're around anymore, but they were over in Franklin, North Carolina. And you could pay them, I think it was $75 or something. And you could go there for a number of weeks and intern in their shop and learn how to do it.
Nice.
And so Mike and I decided, you know, hey, let's go to North Carolina. So we signed up, drove all the way to North Carolina, and realized that interning in the shop really meant that you were just labor. And nobody was really going to teach you anything. But Mike and I were both pretty sharp. And what it did is it got our hands on tooling. So it got our hands on big chisels. It got our hands on the mallets. It got our hands on the bigger saws, the chain mortisers, things like that, that you really, where would you trip over one of those if you weren't in a timber frame shop? Mm-hmm. And so we spent a couple weeks there cutting joinery and picking the brain of the owner as much as we could. And then came back to Kansas, and I was building a big addition on a place, and he was building a big addition on, or building a house, same county, different area. Both of those projects needed like walkout two-story decks. And so we decided to build timber frame decks just because we wanted to practice. And so I think we actually paid the owners to let us do it by the time you figured out what your labor was. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have all the tooling. So instead of using a chain mortiser, we were trying to use drills, doing anything we could do to try to do this. Had no idea how to pre-fit anything. But we struggled our way through, and they look fine, and they're still standing. And then I decided I wanted to build my house. And that started a whole nother design process of trying to figure out how big, what do I feel comfortable with as far as design goes, talking to an engineer who didn't want to talk to me because he didn't understand it either at the time. Once I built my house, I was still a fireman. Once I got the frame in the air, got it covered up with the structure insulated panels, the SIPs. And I was up in the loft working on something, John, and I had my Sunday best coveralls on, you know, the ones that have tar stains on it and paint and, you know, all caulking smeared on the side and all kind of stuff. And I'm out in the country, and I hear a guy walking across my subfloor. And I look down from the loft, and I said, hey, can I help you? And he said, yeah, I'm with the Hutchinson News, and we heard about this place and just wanted to know if we could interview you. I said, okay.
Wow.
So
okay.
He takes a couple pictures, asks me what in the world I'm doing. I try to explain it. You got to remember at the time, I didn't know what I didn't know. it was a good article. He got some good pictures of the frame. And that article came out in the Thanksgiving edition of the Hutch News, and half the state read that article. And I get a phone call from a guy about 45 minutes down the road, and he said, man, we'd love to have a house like that. And he goes, can you build it for us? I said, sure. And he said, what's the name of your company? And I said, I don't know. I'll get back to you on that. We're just a couple firemen doing this on the side.
Sure.
So that started it. And so I think the first – see, we've been in business since 99. I left the fire department in February of 01. So the first couple years, we were doing it on our off days and employing, you know, off-duty firemen to do this stuff. And we're building houses in multiple states. So I quit because the timber framing got too big. And so I quit to do that full time. Somebody had to man the phones and do all that kind of stuff. We hired one full-time employee. And then Mike stayed at the fire department. He had like 3 years before he retired. And so after he retired, he was full time for another 3 or 4 years or so. And then it was too much at that point. And so I bought him out. Now, he's still a great friend. I still call him out of retirement now and then. So it's just me at this point. It's not John and Mike anymore. It's just me.
Gotcha. How much older is Mike?
I'm 53. Mike is 60. Mike is 64, I believe.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And Mike's one of those marathon guys. I mean, he's one of those guys that has stayed in way too good a shape. So he'll probably outlive us all.
There you go. Well, that is pretty cool. The whole serendipity of everything. And I think a lot of our lives are like that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you don't know when you turn this stone over, you're never sure what's quite underneath it. And then what that's going to lead to next. And you almost have to get far enough down the road that you can look back and see how everything was a setup for the next thing. But at the time, you don't realize that.
Right. At first, it was, I'm going to try this. Do you think that you've developed a passion for this?
Yes. Yes. So initially, the first 5 to 7 years, I was really enamored with the tradition of it. We tried to approach things as traditional as we could. Now, the traditional hotspots for timber framing in North America are certainly not central Kansas. It would be New England in some pockets there up there in the Northwest. And the New England timber framers, certain, not all of them, but quite a few of them have a very different mindset than the rest of the country does when it comes to building. There's a lot of folks there that it's not just their job, it's their way of life. Mm-hmm. And I tried to capture that. I tried to hold on to that. And after about, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, yeah, that wasn't working for me. And I think it would have been if I lived in New Hampshire or if I lived in Rhode Island or a place like Vermont, whatever. But being out here, you're pretty isolated from all the rest of them. And even though I went to some of the National Timber Frame Guild conferences, I mean, their ebb and flow of life and my ebb and flow of life were night and day different.
Could you explain what you mean by that?
They seem to need to be understood by everybody else that's around. So there was this desire there for a time. I think it's still there. I've dropped out of the guild since, so I'm not quite sure what the letters are back and forth anymore. They really wanted to be recognized by the industry as a whole, as a viable building mechanism. And to do that, they had to figure out ways to qualify the people that were actually doing it. So, for instance, if somebody wants to be an electrician, they go through steps or stages of they're a journeyman or they have these different rankings for where they are on learning the trade. Since we were isolated out here in the Midwest, it was difficult to play along meaning if I wanted to send my employees so that they could rise up on the rank and have some little card they could put in their wallet that says now they're a journeyman, I had to send them somewhere else. I also didn't, I didn't think it was a wise move to try to be registered with the Department of Labor, because that just puts you on the radar. And I thought timber framing worked really well off the radar. Mm-hmm. In fact, I mean, we're a niche way to build, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I thought going mainstream was not something that I was interested in. And it sounds like I'm knocking those guys. I'm not. I mean, if that's a direction that they wanted to go, great. But I didn't have to be a part of that. And so I backed away from the national camaraderie and being out here in Kansas, which is not a whole lot of us in the Midwest. You know, they left us alone, and I was fine with that. Mm-hmm. As long as I can make the engineer happy, then legally I'm good. I don't need to be part of a club to do it.
So as you've kind of not worried about that aspect of being part of the club, do you pay any particular attention to the traditional methods, or do you just say, I've got some of this, and you just put together a finely crafted timber frame home, but you're not necessarily worried about every traditional nuance?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there are traditional ways in which a timber frame is laid out. And when I say laid out, I mean you get a whole pile of timbers in from the sawmill, it comes off the truck, you unload it, you put it in your shop. And then from there, you're sorting. You're saying, okay, these are the posts, these are beams, these are rafters, these are purlins, whatever they are. And then there's an order by which you do layout, and there's a method, different methods that folks employ to make sure that when you put everything together, if that gable end is supposed to be 30 feet wide, that it is 30 feet wide, even though there's six different timbers joined together in there somehow. Mm-hmm. So there's a square rule method that's very popular. There's a scribing methods that are popular. Mike and I didn't get taught that when we were in North Carolina. And so we just kind of made up our own system, and I just call it the Clydesdale way. And so when I hire employees, they get taught the Clydesdale way. Now, the key to the Clydesdale way is you got to be pretty sure that the timbers that you have coming off the truck are true. So if it's an 8x12, it better measure 8x12. If it measures 7.5 by 11.75, that messes up the Clydesdale way. So there's really a partnership that has to form between me and the mill. And I have to make sure I order it correctly. I have to make sure that the mill is actually going to cut it and then surface it correctly so that what I get fits our layout method. Mm-hmm. When I would do trade shows, like the log home timber frame shows, I learned an awful lot about the industry just after the shows were over in the evening. All the timber framers would get together and have dinner. Trade talk. So you're talking back and forth. Hey, how do you guys do this? How do you do that? And it was interesting, the more that I listened, to realize that we're kind of doing it our own way.
Everybody.
Well, a lot of those guys, you know, they all came out of a New England mindset. So they were all using like the square rule method of layout. And what we were doing was a little different.
Got you.
Similar, but a little different. That's when I just started calling it the Clydesdale way. You know, raisings, how you actually raise timbers or install timbers, people have different mentalities on how to do that. I've never seen another company raise a frame ever. And so I don't know if we're doing it right, like quote unquote correctly. What I know is that 3,000 square feet, we raise in about 10 hours. That sounds fast to me.
And you're using heavy equipment, like a little crane, if necessary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'll have a crane, we'll have a telehandler, and certainly whatever scaffolding we need to get guys all the way up there to the ridge and back.
So how does that differ? I mean, obviously, take, for instance, say the Amish that are building structures, and a lot of times they're doing it in a method like you're talking about. Okay, not necessarily like you're talking about, but they will do some type of timber frame construction, but they don't always have that type of equipment. How do they approach that? How do they get the beams way up there? How do they do that differently?
Great question. Never seen them do it.
Okay.
Never seen them do it. I mean, I can only imagine that they're using tractors and pulleys and ropes and some kind of gin pole. So a gin pole would have a pulley mounted on it way up high at the top of the gin pole. And the gin pole would have some type of 2x6s screwed to it, nailed to it to make legs so the thing doesn't fall over. Mm-hmm. You attach one end of the rope to the timber. The rope runs through the pulley, hooks to the tractor. As the tractor drives, it pulls the timber up in the air. I mean, I can only imagine they're using some of those types of methods, but that's certainly not the way we do it.
So you talked before about this being a niche, but you know, as I follow different people on Facebook and Instagram and I get exposure, there's people all over the United States doing timber frame. I would just say it's such a small percentage comparatively.
Yeah. I mean, if you compare us to the overall building market, we're not even the dog. We're the pimple on the dog. I mean, so there's still way more people doing log homes than there are doing timber frame homes. Was it 2010 that we had the crazy economy crash? Do I got the dates right? Was it about 2010, somewhere in that neighborhood?
Yes, 2008, 2010, somewhere around in there.
Okay. So before that, I might have my numbers off here, but before that, I can remember I took some time trying to figure out how many timber framers were in North America. And I came up with like 350, something like that. After that crash,
oh no,
it was half that many. Now, where they are now, as far as numbers, I don't know. I mean, we've kind of, I don't want to say we've shut the door on it because that isn't true. I just don't pay attention. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know where the numbers are, you know, in Canada, in America now, as far as number of timber framers, if that's a growing thing again, I don't know.
I think it'd also be interesting to see how many home builders there were back then and versus how many home builders were left after the fallout.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It, you know, you're right. It is more popular now for a stick frame house to have heavy timber elements on their porches.
Absolutely.
Or a couple big trusses in the great room or something. That is a lot more prevalent now than it was 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, if we were building a frame for somebody, it was the whole thing. Now we do way more commercial, and then a lot of these little trusses here, porches here, gazebos there. That single family residence, 2,500 to 3,500 square feet, you know, quick, fast, simple. We don't do a lot of those anymore. I wish we did. We'd love those.
So what do you see as the viability going forwards, like, you know, long term?
Yeah, great question. I mean, so with wood, timber frame is the strongest structure you can build with wood. I mean, you can always build a concrete bunker and put 5 foot of earth over the top of it. There's still plenty of forest. All of those places in the Northwest replant. In Kansas here, you know, you plant and you harvest wheat on a yearly cycle. In the Northwest, you know, Douglas fir is harvested and planted on like an 80 to 90 year cycle. Mm-hmm. As long as we keep replanting, we should have wood. Now, you could get in the whole political mess of, you know, how many container loads of wood are going overseas to China and all of those different kind of things. I don't want to run down that road. But it seems like there's a sustainable wood supply. The costs obviously have increased in 23 years. The cost of timber has certainly gone up, but it hasn't gone up as high percentage-wise as, say, fuel costs have. So the shipping of things has, you know, quadrupled in 20-some years. And so everything costs more than it did. It's frustrating to be in a market where the majority of the people that build timber frames can't actually afford one. Mm-hmm. And that seems silly, but it's true. But it's true. I mean, and there is a lot of labor. At the end of the day, I mean, there's a ton of labor in trying to get a frame square, level, plumb, and then have everything look right. You know, it has to look furniture quality, and you're dealing with a product that does move.
So as we look at the sustainable harvesting of the wood, do the techniques that you use today, how much different is it from the wood in the past when you had the rings that were closer together, denser? Maybe the structural capability of the wood was different.
Yeah, definitely so. So if you take a log and you lay it down on a set of sawhorses and you look at the end of it or the butt of the log, you'll see the growth rings of that tree. Years and years ago, when trees were allowed to grow 150, 200 years, 300 years before they were logged, depending on the species, some species don't grow 300 years, but you get my point. Those growth rings would tighten up and tighten up and tighten up. And what it would do is it would make that wood more dense. The denser the wood, typically the stronger the wood is. In some species, you can have wood that's too dense. And so it's super strong in the form of a post, but if you put it in a beam and apply load to, it can actually shatter. And so you do want your timber to be somewhat elastic. But back to the main part of the question. Yes, the timber that we use today is typically all new growth. It's not old growth. The only difference between old growth and new growth is just how long it's been there before you cut it down. So typically our trees are 80, 90, 100 years old. And I'm talking about Douglas fir. I should probably make that up. That's what we use the most of. That's what I'm the most familiar with. We do use white oak and some yellow pine and some other species, but mainly Doug fir is what I'm talking about when we talk about timber. So the design values that are used by the engineers to figure the strength of an 8x12 spanning over 18 feet with a loft floor load on it of, say, 50 pounds per square foot, 60 pounds per square foot, dead load and live load all combined, that kind of thing. They have to, the design values that they use now have a higher safety factor built into them than they may have been using 50 years ago. And it's because the trees are not as dense as they were then.
If you're using Douglas fir, is that the best choice or is that the most cost-effective ratio choice?
I think it's both. And the reason why I say that is, so I'll compare it to white oak. In a laboratory, white oak is stronger than Douglas fir. In real life, it's not. And here's what I mean. If I need to span 18 feet and hold up a floor load, like the example that I just cited, the Doug fir beam is going to be a smaller cross section to hold up the same load than the white oak beam would be. And the reason for that is that white oak is twice as heavy. So Doug fir is going to weigh about 3 pounds, 2.5 to 3 pounds a board foot. A board foot is a volume measurement for timber. White oak is going to be twice that. And so the white oak timber has to hold itself up as well as whatever load that you're putting on top of it. That usually results in a bigger beam. So if you're pricing things per board foot, which is typically how timber is purchased, you want to use the smallest diameter that you can. Now, these are still big pieces. Mm-hmm. The smallest diameter that you can because you're paying by the board foot. If an 8x12 will do it, there's no reason to put a 10x14 there.
Right.
The other part of the Doug fir that we like is that the Northwest, man, those trees grow tall and they grow straight. Mm-hmm. And so I can get 34 footers. If I need a really big piece that's a 12x16 or something like that, or even I've got some 16x20s before, so for some really big posts, and I need 34 feet, I can get it. I can't get that in oak. Getting a 30-foot timber in oak is very difficult to do, and the bigger of a piece that you need in oak, the more rare it becomes, which means cost goes up. Mm-hmm. Now, white pine, I ought to mention that white pine in the New England forests are still prevalent, and you can get really, really big pieces in white pine, similar to Doug fir, nice, long, straight pieces. White pine just doesn't have the strength of Doug fir. If your strength to weight ratio for timber framing, Doug fir is the premier North American product to use.
So when you have a customer that approaches you, they'd like to get a house built, they may or may not have an idea. How do you go through that whole process with them?
I ask them if they have any preference on species. And if they do, we have the conversation. If they don't, it's Doug fir.
When you have a customer that approaches you and they want a timber frame home, how do you begin the whole process of putting together their package and their design to the final product?
Great question. So I have to use names. I think better if I have a name. So let's say that my clients come in, Mr. and Mrs. Kevin Navolio. All right. So the Navolios come in and they're going to talk to me about their dreams, their desires to have a timber frame home. They typically have something that they're bringing. It could be something sketched out on a pizza box lid. It could be something they pulled off of the internet. It could be a picture in a magazine. They have some idea of what they're after. And so rather than starting design with floor plans, we start design with shape. And so we talk through a little bit about square footage, because there's a lot of places anymore that when you build, there's like a minimum square footage that they have to hit, or the homeowners association won't allow the house to be built there. And so I try to get through those conversations so I can get a sense of the size and the scope. And then as I'm looking at whatever it is that they brought me, even if it is just floor plan, we want to figure out roof shape. So Eric, who's my draftsman, Eric and I sit down with Mr. and Mrs. Kevin Navolio and have this conversation. And through that conversation, I'm typically sketching on a big whiteboard that we have in the office, kind of drawing things out three-dimensional, just with dry erase, just to get a sense of what does it look like? What do they like? What do they not like? Because, you know, I mean, it could be, let's say you have a 30 by 40, 1,200 square feet floor plan, and Mrs. Navolio, all she wants to know is that her kitchen's going to be on the left of her front door and she walks in, and the master bedroom's going to be on the right.
Okay.
This sounds really callous, but at that point in the conversation, I don't care. Is it a hip roof? Is it a gable roof? Is it a gambrel roof? Are there dormers? Is there porches? What's going on there that makes the shape? And so that's what we try to figure out first thing. And then we get some idea of it on the whiteboard, put some dimensions to it. And typically I'll take some pictures of it and my draftsman will take some pictures of it. And then he's going to draw in CAD that shape that gets length, width, height, pitch. It gets all that stuff exactly right. We add porches, walkout basements, attachments to garages, whatever the wish list is. And then we just kind of play that email game and we're emailing it back and forth to the clients to say, is this what you want it to look like? So we're showing them views, three-dimensional views, like you're up in a tree looking down at it from different angles. Mm-hmm. And we're just trying to capture shape, John. Once they're happy, and usually that'll take, you know, three or four variations. And once they're happy, then we do frame design, because my frame doesn't care where the kitchen is. Mm-hmm. But it does care what the roof is doing. Mm-hmm. And so then we design the frame to fit the shape of the house. Otherwise, if we start with floor plan, I'll find myself caught in conversations where, you know, we don't have anything drawn yet. And I'm listening to what color I want my cabinets to be. And I'm like, okay, we're wasting everybody's time right now because we're nowhere near worrying about cabinets. We're still trying to figure out what's the frame doing. Mm-hmm. Because we're a frame-only company. We're not a general contractor.
Right.
And so I'm not going to hang those cabinets. I'm just building the frame. And so that's where we focus. Now, if their ideas are outlandish in the sense that there's half circles or octagonal shapes or things like that, that goes a long way to dictate what does that roof look like. Because the roof in a timber frame is where you spend your money. If you think about a 30 by 40 rectangle again, and I have a ridge beam that runs across that 40 feet, across the length, and it's just one direction, that's a lot cheaper to build than if I have that ridge beam, and then I have ridge beams that are pointing out the front door and then pointing out the back door. And now I have, you know, it just, the square footage doesn't change, but the roof gets more complicated. So you spend your money in the roof all the time. And so we're trying to figure that out early so that we can help them then with budgeting decisions, because it's always about how much does it cost. Does that answer the question that you were trying to get to?
I think that's a great answer. Today's trivia question is, how many people died that were involved in the project of carving their presidential faces on Mount Rushmore? This great conversation with John Bruggen was so long, I broke it up into two parts. You've just listened to part one. The next episode is part two, and in this second part, John also gets into some humorous stories. Additionally, you get to hear the tale of how he cut off some of his fingers on a very powerful table saw. Here is a little snippet.
And about 30, 40 minutes later, I have a piece that I'm sliding through, and it starts to kick. Ugh. Now, when a piece kicks, it's going to come back and hit you right in the mouth. And so I'm sliding it through with my right hand. And so I just try to put some weight, you know, down on that piece so it wouldn't kick and hit me in the face. And it kicks. I'm not even sure what happens because it happens in a blink of an eye, but my hand rolls through that blade.
Oh my God.
And I knew it got me. And so what's the first thing you do when you have that kind of thing? You take your hand and you wrap it up in the bottom of your t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why t-shirts are so comforting, but for some reason they are. And I wrapped it up and kicked the saw off. And of course it made an awful sound and everybody in the shop looks.
This was a long conversation, and I broke this up into two parts. Check out part two for the rest of the conversation.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Blue Collar Voices show. On this episode's page on bluecollarvoices.com, you will find show notes and any relevant links. If you are not subscribed to get notifications of new show episodes, you can do that at bluecollarvoices.com as well. Hey! Let me know what you think. I'd love to hear from you. See you next time.
I'll be back.